suggested that we reject this entire amendment bill completely, even though you know that NEDLAC, 80% of this amendment bill has been accepted by the NEDLAC partners. So I just want to know how you reconcile your position with what is obviously a consensus position in NEDLAC. Thank you.
Okay.
Perhaps we have more concern with the poor and the unemployed. And NEDLAC represents big business, big labor, and big government, obviously. And it may be easier for big business in particular to agree to provisions which are very damaging to smaller businesses, and particularly which are damaging to the poor and the unemployed. And I think that business is quite wary of seeing to confront the government on an important policy issue. And this also erodes their capacity, perhaps be as frank as they might otherwise be in a forum such as NEDLAC. The South African Institute of Race Relations, which has condemned racial discrimination and racial classification since the start in 1929, would like to see the country move away from racially based laws, and critically would like to see the country move towards policies that will promote growth, investment and jobs, so that the great mass of people who are without income for employment are no longer in that plight. And in order to achieve that, as I said, we also need to reverse the poor situation of our schools and make sure that people who go into school for 12 years come out with really good, marketable skills at the end of it.
Just for I think a brief clarity, and then that's the question I asked earlier also to one of the presenters. So we should not propose laws which will, in their spirit and letter, promote equality, promote demographic representation and all of that, just because the conditions for those laws do not exist. So we should wait for a period in which our schools can be, or universities can produce graduates who can then fill in those positions before we make or enact those laws, because I think that's the kind of confusion that I'm finding myself into.
I think we should be deeply concerned about the plight of the poor, and the poor are primarily the people who suffered most under apartheid. But we need to be realistic in the steps that we take to try and help them. And since the Employment Equity Act came in 1999, we have seen that the people who benefit from it are really the relative middle class, and that the problem of unemployment is growing worse, that economic growth is faltering, and we need therefore to be considering very carefully whether we're on the right path towards providing redress for those who suffered under apartheid. And if we could get the skills right, attract investment, have very much more growth, then we would in fact be offering opportunities to many more people. And that would supplement what I talked about, what the government has achieved in providing basic social grants, which do provide a level of protection against absolute poverty, and some sort of shelter for people, which have certainly, again, tried to help to raise South Africans out of EverSims 1 to 5, which are the poorest, and into EverSims 6 to 10. But we're not tackling the jobless crisis, and it's that that we need to do. And we can't afford laws which make it more difficult to attract growth or generate jobs.
Yeah, I'm more confused than before you started. I'm actually more confused. But anyway, I hope as I reread your presentation, I'll get more clarity on what position is, but thank you very much.
Could I make one more comment,
okay,
then, which may
all
be
right,
of clarification? Obviously in the mining sector there are laws of various kinds, but there is an employment equity element in it too, which is difficult to meet because of the historical situation in which we find if we look at how mining contracted during the great commodities boom, whereas the mining industry in Chile grew by 12%, I think we must say, what is it that we are doing wrong via our policy choices that make it harder for us to grow and easier for others to do so?
All right. Thank you very much for your submission. We are going to move ahead to receive our final submission for this public hearings in terms of oral presentation from COSATU. And as they move to the fore, to indicate that we have for your submission 10 to 15 minutes, and then from there we will then have a question and answer. Honorable Nyakemba, fresh from lunch, thank you for joining us. You look ready for COSATU. Okay. When you're ready, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon to everyone present. On behalf of COSATU, we'd like to thank you for inviting us to make this presentation. I think already, as previously indicated, we actually broadly in support of both bills, as reflected in terms of the negotiation process that arose out of NEDLAC. My name is Prakashini Govender. I'm the Parliamentary Office Coordinator of COSATU, and with me on my left is Woodraj Arun from the NUMSA Parliamentary Office. On my right, she is Neil Newman from the Nihawa Parliamentary Office. And they may actually just add any comments at the end. Just at the beginning, I think we just want to address the process. It is actually, I think, a well-known fact that these two bills arose out of a fairly robust engagement. And we managed to achieve a high degree of consensus. It's unfortunate that business is not here because they were fairly robust themselves and were not afraid in those discussions to make themselves heard. The discussions actually did focus and look at the implications and consequences
From Capes.
Right. Sorry.
Capes is still here, part of business.
Yeah, okay, I was referring
to
the booster representative from the task team at NEDLAC.
Yes, oh, okay.
And we think that the bills have an important role to play as far as employment equity is concerned. Obviously, there's a constitutional impediment arising from Section 9 of the Bill of Rights. We also need to take a step back and assess the dismal lack of progress that has been made in terms of implementation of the Employment Equity Act since its inception in 1998. Also, in relation to more broadly, we would have to look into the socioeconomic context within which we actually, in which these bills come arise. And we are currently sitting at a situation where unemployment is at 25.6%. And if you factor in the discouraged work seekers, that actually adds a further 2.36 million workers that, in fact, in terms of the broader definition of unemployment. Our view is that a significant amount of unemployment and inequality is actually exacerbated by the failure for government to intervene strategically in relation to the labor market. And we think that these bills are actually quite important in terms of addressing some of the problematic trends that have arisen. We're not going to make comprehensive comments because we've dealt with that in the NEDLAC engagement as a result, so we'll focus on more key provisions. I will deal with the Employment Equity Amendment Bill first. We support the definitional changes, firstly in relation to designated employers. You'll see that the definition is expanded to include local government in relation to Chapter 3, which is the requirements to prepare employment equity plans and to report in relation to the implementation of those plans. It has never made sense for us that municipalities have been exempt, and apart from covering a wide range of sectors, you'll find that the disparities that continue within and between municipalities across the country is actually quite fairly entrenched, and a lot of that is along racial and gender lines. We also support the definition, the amendment of the definition of designated groups, which essentially qualifies the definition of black people and women and people with disabilities, and limits it to those who are citizens before 1994, or who could have been naturalized before 1994, but prevented from being naturalized because of apartheid legislation. And the main emphasis of this is obviously that affirmative action is supposed to redress the advantage or the disadvantage experienced under apartheid. So it's a factual addressing of an injustice. So obviously, it would have to target those who've experienced apartheid. We also do want to register upfront that we think that more emphasis, and this is our historical principle stance, more emphasis needs to be placed in relation to how affirmative action can address the position of black women specifically. They continue to be the most marginalized in the labor market, and you'll find that combined with all factors, whether it's socioeconomic, race, geography, those factors clue to further entrench substantially entrench the disadvantages way beyond what any other group experiences. On the question of unfair discrimination, I think we should note that there are two very important developments. The first is in relation to the recognition or the requirement to redress and recognize terms and conditions in relation to same where people are doing same work or work of equal value. Historically, obviously, where it's easy to identify discrimination where people are doing the same job but earning, for example, different remuneration, or one's receiving other differential conditions, and is able to identify discrimination. But where you have work that tends to be allocated to a particular group, and that category of work historically tends to enjoy fewer benefits or lower remuneration, then it's more difficult, and you'll find that the discrimination tends to remain entrenched. The ILO has criticized South Africa, and we think it is correct, for not having passed legislation to address the redress discrimination where it relates to work of equal value. And historically, we understand that this tended to be associated with discrimination on the lines of gender, but in South Africa, it is gender as well as race. Further on, in terms of unfair discrimination, we think that it's actually quite important that that the new ground has been introduced, which is that of discrimination arbitrary grounds. We found in our experience that many workers are discriminated against doing the same work at the same workplace and then getting vastly different remuneration or different employment, or subject to different employment terms and conditions. And where in these instances there is no rational reason, for example, skills, or and there's also no discriminatory ground to link the discrimination to, for example, race or gender, it has been difficult to address. In fact, legislation doesn't provide a recourse. So for the first time, under an amendment to Section 11, there's provision for redress for discrimination arbitrary grounds, and we think this is an important development. I'm just skipping ahead to. Okay. page 8 on streamlining of compliance and enforcement mechanisms. We just have a bit of view with both bills and just trying to keep time. We think that it's important that the Employment Equity Amendment Bill tries to streamline processes in the bill, because some of these processes have been used to block enforcement of the Employment Equity Act. The first is in relation to Section 36, where the compulsory requirement for a labor inspector to require a written undertaking has now been done away with. So the labor inspector still retains the discretion to impose that as a discretionary step, but is not obliged to do so, and may then obviously proceed to get compliance in relation to the next step. As far as, sorry. There are also amendments to Section 45A, sorry, 45 of the Employment Equity Act, and these amendments are intended to complement the powers of the Director General to conduct reviews of employers' compliance in terms of Section 43. Here, the current section provides that the Director General may refer to the Labour Court and employers' non-compliance in terms of the aforementioned sections, whereas amendments now provide that the Director General may apply directly to the Labour Court either to direct the employer to comply or to impose a fine if the employer fails to justify non-compliance. So here you can see there's a more directive response to achieve the result that we're supposed to achieve. And it also removes intermediary steps that essentially delay the process of enforcement. I think it's important to note that that the right of recourse for employers to object is retained, and it's in relation to the processes outlined under the in relation to the Labour Court. Moving on to assessment of compliance on page 9. You look at section 42, it relates to the Director General's power to assess compliance in implementing employment equity and in relation to their plans. Controversially, the initial draft of the bill that was published in 2010 deleted the words national, regional from section 42.1, which required the Director General to consider the demographic profile of the national and regional economically active population when determining whether designated groups are equitably represented in the workforce. And this raised concerns about how this may be used in specific geographic areas and whether or not regional elements would then be disregarded. But you'll note that this section has been retained as currently drafted in the current Employment Equity Act. And further, if there are any regulations that will be developed in this regard, they will be taken to NEDLAC. Our main concern, obviously, at the time was any unintended consequences, and the concerns were in relation to how that would be technically interpreted. For example, how you'd interpret a national company which had a national presence and versus a national company, for example, that didn't have a national presence. But these are things that would have to be resolved on a technical basis through a regulatory regulations process. But we believe that that the redrafted section has adequately addressed the concerns that were initially raised, and the main emphasis, obviously, of these amendments was to drive forward enforcement, which has been lagging behind. In relation to fines, you'll see that the amounts have been increased, not only to address, obviously, the question of inflation, but also to address the question of, as we believe that it's currently too lenient. It also amends the structure of how the fines are approached. So you'll find, for example, the contraventions, there's a distinction between sections 16, 19, 22, 24, 25, and 26, which are somewhat, if you look at the amounts allocated, are offenses of a lesser degree versus offenses in relation to 20, 21, 20, 44, and 44B. And those that relate to, for example, your compliance with your reporting and things that are that are actually significant in addressing the impact of the Employment Equity Act. I'm now going to move on to the Employment Services Bill. Unlike the Employment Equity Act, where Amendment Bill, which had a central thread which is to address unfair discrimination and to promote employment equity, the Employment Services Bill contains a range of different employment-related matters that are not really connected, and it's just, you know, and some of it is to actually plug gaps, and some of it is to address just technical issues. For example, the relocation of Productivity SA to under the authority of the Department of Labour, since the amendments in relation to the Skills Development Act relocated the authority of the Skills Development Act to the Department of Higher Education. On our comments and specific sections, I think we want to draw attention to the provision on the introduction of the enhanced role for the Department of Labour to provide free public employment services, which we think is important because this would to some extent address issues where you'd have work seekers who are disadvantaged, whether through lack of information or access to networks or just access to the newspaper or just finances to be able to go out and look for work. They'd be able to use the services to be able to track jobs. And the way it would work, as we understand it, is that employers would be required to register vacancies with the Department of Labor. This doesn't prevent them using private employment services, but whatever vacancies they do have, they would have to register with the Department of Labor, which would then, for example, in terms of its own database, be able to refer work seekers to those employers. And we think that that is an important example of how government can play a more interventionist role to address unemployment. Section 6 deals with the power of the minister to establish work schemes facilitating entry of youth and other vulnerable workers into employment. We generally support this clause, as we also understand that it would not introduce a multi-tiered labour market, because the emphasis here is that the work scheme would be subject to the minimum terms of conditions as determined by the BCA or a collective agreement if that is in place. Notwithstanding our general support, we are actually calling for an amendment to subsection 6.1 to replace the word board, to require that where a work scheme is established, it should be done in consultation with NEDLAC, because we think that this is a policy matter that affects socioeconomic policy. On page 13, we deal with the provisions relating to the employment of foreign nationals, and this is covered under sections 8 and 9 of the bill. firstly, in relation to the section, you find that foreign national, for the purposes of this bill, excludes permanent residents who will be treated or afforded the same status as South African citizens. And the emphasis here is to enforce requirements that employers only employ foreign nationals who have valid immigration documentation. They must also first satisfy themselves that there is no South African citizen or permanent resident that has the skills to fill a vacancy before recruiting a foreign national person. The idea is to obviously balance the requirements of the difficulties and challenges that we're facing with unemployment as well. A concern here, obviously, and our support here is obviously related to the trends or the usage or reliance on undocumented labour, where you'll find where workers are often employed on inferior working conditions, which contributes to a multi-tiered labour market, which in turn has had, has escalated or increased the incidence of xenophobia, where we have instances where local workers incorrectly target immigrant workers as opposed to bosses who perpetrate the exploitation of workers. And we think that this would have an important side effect to actually address that multi-tiered labour market. We also want to express support for the provision which states that where a foreign worker is an undocumented migrant worker, which means they're not here, they don't have the correct work permit, they would still be able to enforce their labor rights against an employer. And we think that this this is in line, obviously, with an opinion that was gotten by the CCMA that it was possibly unconstitutional. But apart from that, the denial of workers their contractual rights of compensation for work that, that they have conducted actually seeks to penalize a vulnerable worker rather than an employer who has exploited the irregularity. And we think that it's important that the overall approach should target employers for compliance with labor and immigration laws as opposed to vulnerable migrant workers. With regard to private employment agencies, here we note that private employment agencies are not limited to labor brokers or temporary employment services, but they include agencies that provide other employment services, such as assisting clients with recruiting employees without entering into a triangular employment relationship. So we maintain our position, which is a ban on the labor broking, but in principle, we note that there is a need for provisions that deal more generally with the regulation of private employment agencies. And accordingly, we support the various provisions here which requires or introduces the requirement to apply for registration, as well as the standards and requirements that are set out in relation to maintenance, retention, and confidentiality of information. We also support Section 15, which provides that private employment agencies may not charge fees for providing, may not charge work seekers fees for providing employment services, which we understand is in line with Article 7 of the International Labour Organization's Private Employment Agencies Convention. In relation to the promotion of protected work for persons with disabilities, which is dealt with under Chapter 6 of the Bill, and this ranges from Sections 42 to 47, we understood that this was to almost regularize the arrangements and the administration of the service factories that were established in 1948. And these service factories will be reconstituted as protected employment services, and such they will operate as a national government component, which would then bring them closer or under the administration of the department. And we thought that this would be a provision to support. Notwithstanding this, and we're not asking for an amendment in this case in relation to this bill, we strongly believe, and we've raised in the NEDLAC process, that there is a need for further policy processes that would deal with enabling and promoting opportunities that would ensure that workers with disabilities have opportunities to actually work in the mainstream labor market. One concern is that sheltered employment tends to marginalize workers, and it remains a dead-end option rather than a transitional mechanism. And if we have to use an example, if you take an unskilled or semi-skilled worker who, through an accident, for example, loses their legs, they're going to have a huge difficulty entering the mainstream labor market without some kind of support from government, and would extend beyond the domain of your sheltered employment factories as we understand it. This, as compared to, for example, an accountant who loses use of the legs, and we're not here trying to trivialize the hardship, the difficulties and challenges that present, but we're just saying we're trying to differentiate here the barriers that are then set up in terms of entering the mainstream labor market, and the need for interventions that actually start to more holistically address that beyond what we see here. And there we'd obviously call for a consultative process that would include all stakeholders, including organizations representing people with disabilities. That concludes our presentation. I'm not sure if anybody else has questions, but we thank you for the opportunity to present it.
All right, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I'd like to invite colleagues to present questions. Yep. Honorable Mutau, Honorable Fanda Vasteza, Honorable Nyakemba.
Thank you, Chair. Latching on to sort of, it's almost like a throwaway remark from Cusato about the notwithstanding our continued call for the ban on labor broking, specifically da-da-da-da-da. I have never been able to understand why Cossato wants to have labor broking banned. Maybe you can explain it to me so that I can walk out of here understanding why. Because I don't see that it would pass muster constitutionally. And I don't see how it facilitates employment. My position with regard to labor law is labor law has got to facilitate employment, creation, retention, and all of the good things that I believe all of us want. So I haven't been able to understand it. Maybe I'm missing something.
Okay, Honorable Fanner Verstegen, and just a reminder that there's something on there, but just a reminder that this is the Employment Equity and the Employment Services Amendment Bills. Just that reminder is important. You've had several bouts on the 0-3-6 months. So
she started it.
Thank you. Chair, in terms of the Employment Equity Amendment Bill and your stance on foreign labor and laborers, I appreciate your positive stance towards bringing people, undocumented laborers also, into the protection of the law. But it is also my understanding that in terms of this bill, there's been a new definition whereby for it to be a designated employee that you now need to be a South African citizen, or you need to be naturalized before 1994, etc. We have heard this morning also a view which says, but you know, skilled people coming to South Africa contribute to our economy, and each of those skilled foreign immigrants then also, you know, lead to the employment of six other South Africans. What is Cossato's stance then on this new definition, which it seems to me will make less attractive for South African employers to employ foreign laborers? Thank you.
Honorable Williams.
Thanks, Jefferson. I've just got one small question. With regard to both of the bills before us, I might be wrong, but the only suggested or recommended amendment was point 6 of section 6 of the Employment Services Bill, where you want to change consulting the board to consulting NEDLAC. Is there any other amendments you could give us, like you could say want to change another? I might have missed it. If we could just get that. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen. What for me is in relation to and inviting your comment on the presentation that was made before you around the issue of affirmative action in the main. That the difficulty of getting black people who can occupy managerial positions. I could say that you do support the amendments that relate to that, even if you have, I mean, you have made comments to that. Have you ever came across with a difficulty of getting a black person be placed in a managerial position, as it was alleged earlier? Doesn't bite in the comment. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll hand over to Cossato to respond.
Okay, I'm going to respond very briefly to the labor brokers because that wasn't the focus. because we did have to deal with private employment agencies, which is a very broad category and includes a range of other services of which only labor brokers is one. So we had to raise it to differentiate that we had not withdrawn our call. But obviously we emphasized that that differentiation. And for us, there's the experience in terms of exploitation that a worker under labor broker, from our experience, and workers themselves will tell you that, whereas those versus those who are employed directly enjoy better conditions and remuneration. And it's a question of simple mathematics. If you have two people in employment equation versus three people in employment equation, you've got to redistribute those costs somehow. So how employers reduce the costs and manage to use a third party in an employment relationship economically does not make sense unless the most vulnerable is going to be squeezed through that, and that's going to be the worker who's employed through the labor broker. On the question of foreign laborers, I think we meant with foreign workers, which would include, for example, workers of all levels. I think we need to draw a distinction between how foreign workers are dealt with in the Employment Services Bill versus the Employment Equity Act. And that's why, for example, when I said foreign nationals are defined for the purposes of the Employment Services Bill, it meant that it's limited to that bill. It doesn't have anything to do with the Employment Equity Act or any other piece of labor legislation for that matter. It's only for that interpretation. And in this case, it relates to only workers who are in an, for example, undocumented status, or someone who has a work permit, temporary work permit, but excludes a foreign permanent resident. And we, in that arrangement, we understand that migrant workers, especially low-skilled workers, are amongst the most marginalized and exploited and continue to be so. And we obviously support and the protection of those workers. We're also opposed to a multi-tier labor market as far as the Employment Services Bill, and we think that the Employment Services Bill takes us forward in that respect. We also, as we've explained, that it is incorrect when you have an undocumented migrant worker who has worked for an employer, and then suddenly the employer, as often happens, reports them to immigration, has them deported without having to pay them. So it doesn't mean that the worker enforcing their rights against the employer, their contractual rights against the employer, does not change their immigration status, but it also does not allow an employer to profit from that. And as we see, we are supposed to be promoting the employment of documented migrant workers, but we also should be placing the obligation and penalizing non-compliance with employers who retain the power. As far as the Employment Equity Act is concerned, and that's very different because essentially we're dealing with designated employees. We're dealing with Chapter 3, which is affirmative action, which is about redress. Redress of a historical, factual situation. Did you experience disadvantage as a result of apartheid? So obviously, those who were here prior to 1994, or who could not have citizenship because of apartheid law, because they were disenfranchised and they were in exile, can benefit because that is as a direct result of apartheid legislation. It does not mean that it excludes the employment, and should not mean that it excludes the employment of foreign nationals, whether in a temporary work permit or permanent residence. It just means that it happens within the framework as is envisaged here. In relation to other amendments, I think there's just one other minor amendment. It's in relation to the clause under job retention, and there again, we'd emphasize that there should be consultation with NEDLAC. On the question of affirmative action and whether we've personally had experience, you're dealing with the policy people, you don't, not actually on the work floor, but I don't know if my comrades from the affiliate offices can speak to that. I think for us, I do want to say up front, I think for us what is illustrative is the what's come out from the Employment Equity Report of this year. And if you look at the minimal progress over a 15-year period, which is not acceptable. So I think on that basis, we can at least see from the figures that there is difficulties and there's challenges and that more needs to be done. But I'm not sure if that, I think my other comments, you have other responses as well.
Thank you. Let me just to start with the labour brokers, not long, because the issue is that when we speak about employment, we're speaking about the labour broker owning the worker and then providing the worker to a company who pays the labour broker, and then the labour broker pays a little bit to the worker. The worker don't have rights. They don't have rights, they are owned by somebody else and sold to somebody else. It's not like they, you see, for example, when we, the difference when we speak about temporary employment services, the agency can provide workers to a company, but they become employed by that company. The agency just provides them, gets paid by the company, not by the workers, gets paid by the company, and then, but the workers then become employed by the company, not owned by. I mean, there's been many cases. For example, there was a project looking at Pamela with FAU, and then FAU, when they came, they took Pamela came and took over three South African dairy product companies and made one Pamela. And they retrained 60% of the force and then employed them through labor brokers. When FAU went to employ the workers that are employed by labor brokers, FAU, the Pamela told the company, take those workers away, we'll get other workers somewhere else. Because they're not employed by that company. The very first labor brokers we've ever experienced in the Western Cape was in Portneck, where, you know, on the ship, workers in Portneck can't go on the ship to offload the ship. Once it comes off the ship onto the harbor, nobody else can touch them, only Portneck workers can touch them. And then what did they do? They came and said, well, sit here, wait here for the next ship. To labor brokers then got workers to sit there. When the next ship come in, they say, okay, go on the ship, offload the ship, and that's it. And then the labor broker is paid, not the workers. Then the labor broker gives something to the workers. So it is termed to be almost like modern-day slavery, because they own the workers and their ability to work. That's the small thing about the affirmative action is that this is very difficult because it can be like sometimes but difficult or even conflictual in a sense. But how do you deal with the fact that historically there's been disadvantages? Now you stop the race and you remove all the chains that was holding people back, remove it and say, okay, we've removed it, now we can go forward. We can't. We've got to say, how do we get people to come there that were previously disadvantaged? Because the moment you say, I mean, the problem is where people live, what schools they go to, what skills they have, how they, what food they eat, there's a lot of things that we must overcome. But at the same time, we need to say, let's deal with the issue of the fact that most of the people in the workplace, especially at higher levels, are white.
Okay, is it all from COSATU? Okay, briefly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I'm not going to go into this issue of labor brokers. I think so much has been said about it. It's mind-blowing. And we've had our fair share of experiences in NUMSA as well. I mean, on the docks in Durban, we've had numerous examples. And I think you got to work for a labor broker if you want a different perspective on the matter. You work for a labor broker, you'll have a totally different perspective. In any event, on the issue of foreign nationals, the thing is this, is that the immigration laws, they do provide. I mean, it's not, I don't think the Act is intended to disadvantage foreign nationals from applying for jobs here, but they have to have exceptional skills. And then the question is, well, what are those exceptional skills? And then you'd have to debate that. So I don't think there's an intention that we don't want foreign nationals here. Per se. Certainly, if you take the emerging energy sector in the country and the way it's developing, there's going to be skills that will require expertise from other countries. But I think one has to be clear that. There must be a strong argument that these are exceptional skills and that we must be satisfied beyond doubt that we don't have those skills in the country. And over and above that, we must ensure that when foreign nationals are employed here, they leave something behind. And this mustn't be by word of mouth. There's going to be skills transfer, there's going to be technology transfer. Then we've got to have binding agreements on this. I'll give you an example, for instance. You know, we visited the Clipewell wind. There's three wind turbines here in Clipewell, just outside of Cape Town, outside Durbanville. And they've been there for quite some time. But every year, two of those, which are fitted with turbines made in Denmark, Vestas, up to now, there has been no provision to train anybody to go up and service. Every year those turbines require servicing, they have to send somebody down from Denmark. Now we can't continue like this. We have to have a kind of incremental program to say that we are going to train these skills, that people are going to come here with, foreign nationals are going to come here with certain skills, that they are going to train locals. But we can't go on. Imagine now with the new wind projects that are developing, there's going to be hundreds of turbines. I just been to Mexico recently. I saw thousands of turbines. I saw over 1,000 turbines in the south of Mexico. Now imagine each and every one of that requires servicing and maintenance every year. We're going to bring down 1,000 foreign nationals if we have 1,000 turbines to come and service and maintain these turbines. You know, we have to have an incremental approach to this. So I'm saying that, look, we understand about foreign nationals, but they have exceptional skills, fine, but they have to make sure that those skills are in some ways, that they leave those skills behind so that we develop our own expertise and we are able to build this economy. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Okay, thank you very much, Kosatu, and also thank you very much to all the people who have made submissions today and yesterday throughout the whole of the public hearings. And I think we'd also like to extend our gratitude to the media, the staff, and everybody else who has been here throughout the proceedings. Mm-hmm. And I think just briefly, as by way of closing remarks. Essentially, for us as the portfolio committee, we'll be beginning with the public. I mean, with the deliberations in our next meetings. And we understand that there was an intensive engagements and deliberations at NEDLAC, by which we always view that as an inclusive process. And although in some instances it is not or has not been inclusive, but we are going to be taking what came out of NEDLAC quite seriously. We are also going to be taking out what the submissions that have been made here quite seriously, as we've done with the other two legislations. But I think what is more important for us is how it is the balance in relation to what has been submitted, particularly on aspects which have not been agreed to in the NADLAG process. We will at all times obviously take into consideration the fact that there are historical injustices which needs to be addressed, which has been the essence of the Employment Equity Act and which we think is the essence of the current Employment Equity Amendments Bill. Those, and I think the are a lot of presentations which have been made to the effect that yes, there is a problem with the extent of the punitive measures which are in place and that we need to change those, and that government needs to be seen to be taking serious action against those who do not comply with the law. But consistently, as part of not only this legislation process but also as part of our oversight, we will also be looking at the role of the department in ensuring that there is compliance. This committee has consistently, I think for the last 2 to 3 years, in the budget votes, argued for more resources for the Department of Labor, because we agree with the trade unions, we agree with business, we agree with civil society, we agree with the many people who made presentations here that there is a need to ensure that there is compliance. Yes, we hear what business says, that the measures that are being proposed, the punishment is too harsh, but they agree that there need to be some level of seriousness in terms of government interest. And we must also emphasize that we put at all times the interest of the workers, the interest of the poor, the interest of the particularly those who are not represented, because if people are not unionized, if people do not be small businesses do not belong to business formations or business unions, workers do not belong to worker organizations, it means that they are the most vulnerable, and therefore the law cannot be able to take care of them. And that's why we took quite seriously the concern which was raised by some of the presenters that some of the amendments may lead to people going to court, to the labor court in particular. We worried about the time it may take for matters to be resolved at the labor court. We worried also about the costs of the labor court, and we are going to be taking that quite seriously as a portfolio committee. Our duty is to make it easier and cheaper for ordinary workers, small businesses, and everybody else to resolve, you know, labor-related disputes, because it is not in anybody's interest that labor disputes go on and on. And I think we will also be looking into that issue. There are also a whole range of other critical issues which have been raised. The whole issue of sheltered employment, what we should do with sheltered employment, how do we ensure that it is used to facilitate work for disabled workers in the mainstream economy. I think that's one of the issues which has been raised quite sharply. And whether this Employment Equity Bill would result in a situation where we justify discriminations when its intention should actually be to outlaw discriminations as per the convention. At the center of the temporary employment services, I think, is the whole notion of employment, particularly, or employment creation, particularly for young people. We've noted the concerns that some has raised, particularly business around the requirement for them to register for vacancies, and I think we'll have those deliberations. But I think it's quite surprising that since the department started registering vacancies, there's been significant progress, and that there has actually been cooperation, even though there were businesses were not required by law, you know, that vacancies had actually been registered by the department, and that that has made some progress. So thank you very much for your submissions, contributions, and I think we want to reiterate that although this is the closing of the oral submissions, just as we have done even with the previous pieces of legislation, the committee would still be available for engagement with anybody on any specific issue in the course of our deliberations. And even the members of parliament individually would be available for engagement, for persuasion, for lobbying, until such time these bills are adopted. And they'll also be persuading each other about labor brokers and all those other things. So, but thank you very much to you all. The hearings are closed. That's it.
Yay.